Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Israel Studies. I'm Yaakov Yadgar, the host of the channel. Today, we will be talking to Professor Benjamin Brown about his new book, The Haredim, A Guide to Their Beliefs and Sectors. Brown, a professor of Jewish thought at the Hebrew University, offers in this book a mapping of the various sects that compose Jewish-Israeli ultra-orthodoxy. He aims to provide his readers with a respectful yet critical approach to a rather diverse community, which in many senses has become an Israeli other. Professor Brown, welcome to the show.
Hi.
I wonder if you could begin by telling us a little bit about the background for writing this book. Can you please describe what brought you in the first place to offer such an overview of the ultra-Orthodox sects in Israel?
Yes, actually, many people that I met after the book has been published told me that such a book was very much missing, and they're really happy to have it already. The idea was to give the Israeli reader who wants to get more than a glimpse on Haredi Judaism, something that will be quite comprehensive in the sense of showing the broad picture, but on the other hand, not too nitty-gritty and meticulous in terms of getting into small details or unimportant aspects of the Haredim in the present, in the past. And the idea was to show that this big black block is not so uniform as it might seem to the ordinary reader, and not so uninteresting as or threatening as it may seem to more hostile readers, but something that has its own dynamics, and you can understand even if you don't adopt the Haredi perspective on the world, you can get into it and start thinking in some way out of your box and to some degree within their box and see the world from their eyes in a little different way, which doesn't mean that you have to be convinced by their tenets, but just see that they have their own logic, their own interior logic for the worldview. And for this, you don't need only to get into the ideas themselves, because that would be a much more theological, ideological text, but also to get into the historical and sociological backgrounds that brought this worldview into existence, because after all, Haredi Judaism is a kind of a responsive group, a responsive stream that acts in constant dialogue with modernity. And so I felt the need to balance to some way between the historical, ideological, and sociological levels that give the whole picture to the reader.
I understand. This is exactly the interesting aspect about reading the book. It moves the reader between an ideational or a history of ideas kind of discourse to a more sociological analysis. Can you tell us how your previous work contributed to your overview of the Haredi community at large?
Yes, I came to this field. Actually, it was, if you allow me some personal level confession, yes, I came to this field from different perspective. In the first place, my main fields field of interest is general philosophy. And I studied also law in my first degree in the university. And the fact that I grew up in Bnei Brak, which is the capital, so to speak, of the Haredi, Haredi Jews in Israel. But I found myself more and more, because of my Bnei Brak background, explaining Haredim to non-Haredi people and trying to convey this interior logic, as I internal logic, as I called it before. And the more I really found myself really engaging in that, I found it interesting also, not just as someone who can help people understand, but something that deserves research. So I went into it with the notion that if you know the field, if you know the people in the field, you understand that things are not only ideology and not only halakha. There is really a lot in Haredi ideology and whatever has to do with that, that relates to the field, relates to life, to real life. But on the other hand, if you reduce Haredi Judaism only to sociology and say all they got there is just responses and social means of defense and reaction, you miss a lot. You miss a lot because, as we know, different same challenges can bring forth different responses, different reactions by different people. So people facing the same challenges as them responded differently to them. And the fact that they responded this way and not another way means that they have some form of ideology, even if they phrase it very badly, very poorly. They have some ideology, they have some worldview, and it's in some way it's the mission of the researcher to help them, so to speak, to phrase it better or to phrase it in a way that even non-Haredim will understand. So when I first got into that notion, to that understanding, it was when I already finished my first degree and even practiced law almost a year, and then decided that I would like to leave it and get back into academy. I wrote about one of the most central principles of Haredi Judaism today, which is Da'at Torah. Da'at Torah, Da'as Torah in the Haredi pronunciation, Da'as Torah is a doctrine that attributes powers and authority to the Torah sages and the rabbis that goes far beyond their fields of expertise. They don't only rule in terms in issues of halakha, of Jewish law, and Jewish textual matters, but really in all fields of life. As the Chafetz Chaim phrases it, whoever has the Torah mind, the Torah, can rule, can solve any problem in any field of life, public or private. And this idea, which is taken by most of the Haredim themselves as some kind of dogma, has quite a lot of literature about it within the Haredi world, where they explain it, where they show different approaches to it. And I wrote my MA thesis on that. And once again, people before me, this is was one of the very few Haredi principles that had been taught at that time, already before the field of Haredi thought was developed, and mostly in a historical and sociological levels, how this doctrine serves or functions within the overall Haredi arena. What interested me as someone with the background with more philosophy and theology was not only that, but what's the kind of history of ideas aspect of this doctrine, how it came into existence specifically in that context, but also what was the sources from which it derived its contents, its substance. And I went into that, and that was and the different approaches that exist to reasoning, to justifying this doctrine as well, because there were justifications, and justifications are already a form of thought. And all this attracted me very much, so I wrote my MA thesis on that. And I think that already then I understood that I wanted to do much more in this field. My doctoral dissertation was about the Chazon Ish. When I started writing that, I decided that I want to concentrate on a very, very central figure. I wasn't absolutely sure if it was Chafetz Chaim or the Chazon Ish, but a very central figure, because we don't have the luxuries of writing about non-center figures when the field of Haredi ideology is so undeveloped, was then so undeveloped. A center figure that dealt both with halakha, because I wanted to exercise my halakhic models as well, or legal theoretic models on halakha, both on halakha and on ideology. So the same thing was I did in my dissertation. I portrayed the figure of the Chazon Ish. In the end of the day, I decided on the Chazon Ish, which was much more influential than the Israeli Haredi world. I took the Chazon Ish, I took his historical background, I took his biography, his life story. I wrote about that as well, and in order to get into the picture and understand the subtleties and understand the context in which he lived. Can't understand the text without understanding the context, but that was not the main thing. The main thing was portraying his worldview versus either other ideological and theological streams in the Jewish world that he faced. And also much, much more than both of these, which is the great part of the book, is halachic thinking, is halachic work. Also not analyzed in just traditional ways, but also in legal theoretical models, which help understand them in also non-Jewish studies context as well.
Nice.
So this is what I've done. The bigger works that I had written before this present book, but also in smaller articles and booklets that I've written, I analyzed the intellectual history of the Muslim movement. Muslim movement, also a fascinating movement that hasn't been studied very much, at least not in a popular way. And other themes in Haredi ideology, such as their relation to the State of Israel, their relation to the Israeli democracy and democracy on the whole. Some of these studies went into this new book as well as part of their describing or analyzing their worldview.
Mm-hmm. So if you could offer the listeners a key to understanding the Haredi, Israeli Haredi society, what would it be? Is there one key that has been missing in the way previous discussions of the community have analyzed it?
In the ideological level, I think you can give two main keys. I suggest in the book, in the first chapter, I think, of the book, I wrote what I called the 10 commandments of Haredism, which are the first basic principles, basic ideas that every Haredi person would subscribe on. And the two most principal ideas within those 10, I think, are the authority of the sages, as I said before, Das Tere, and what is derived from that, and the idea, which is a little less studied, the idea of the decline of the generations, meaning that history goes not in course of progress, but on the other way, in a kind of digression. Every generation is lesser than the generation that preceded it. And these two dogmas, I think, are to understand the Haredi worldview, not sociology, not the social dynamics, but Haredi worldview, they're really pivotal. But beyond that, I think Haredi Judaism has other sub-dynamics or patterns of thought that should be studied. For example, we see today, that this is just an example, really just an example, yes, we see today that Haredi Judaism goes through many changes toward some levels of modernity or modernization. You see that all those who come with this or that justification to their modernized way meet a very strong and harsh attack, reaction on the other side of the Haredi map or Haredi social arena. While others who say, come on, I mean, it's personal difficulties, financial difficulties, I can't really study in the yeshiva so long because I'm not patient enough, I have got kind of psychological disturbance, whatever. All those who come with such arguments do not meet such a strong attack or opposition. This is also part of trying to understand the Haredi patterns of thinking, which I use for to describe it, the halachic terms of lechatchila and diavad. If you come with an idea that the change should be done lechatchila, meaning ideologically, with intent, with justification, you're an apikoros, you're a heretic, you're someone who comes against the dogma, you're a kind of rebel. On the other hand, if you go and you ask for much greater changes and much greater concessions, but not in the name of ideology, but in the name of personal need and duresses, people will be much more attentive and even accepting when they come to allow you to do that change. And Haredi Judaism today moves in both tracks. The Haredim who really come with ideology, kind of semi-modernist ideology, and they are the ones who are considered as real rebels and are in some way excluded from the camp. On the other hand, the really big changes that take place are done often by Haredim who don't really challenge the Haredi ideology and really pledge allegiance to Haredi ideology, but on the other hand, in the field, do the greater changes because they actually change their basic mode of life. This is also something that I wouldn't call at all a basic principle or key principle or something to that, something like that. But I would call it as call it something that you should know as if you want to really come to see, come to understand the Haredi psyche, the Haredi mode of thinking. And this is one of the things that this book gives, apart from other similar patterns that that I suggest, often exemplified by cases in Haredi history and Israeli history that manifest it on particular levels.
I see. So what's Israeli about the Haredim? There's obvious comparison of, well, your subject matter to ultra-Orthodoxy in America, Jewish ultra-Orthodoxy in America. What is specifically Israeli about the phenomena you're writing about?
There are two things. One of them, in terms of history, that history actually shaped the present as well, is that Haredi Judaism in the United States did not opt for what we call scholar society. In Israel, Haredim went to a very revolutionary, actually, a revolutionary course that Professor Nachum Friedman called scholar society, which means Chavat Lomdim, yes, in Hebrew, which means that every Haredi adult, even after marriage, does not go to work, does not join the workforce, but keeps studying in a koilel, in a study hall for married men, and actually is supported by the state, by the community, by philanthropists and other people, and runs the way of life that actually doesn't really... he suffices with a low standard of living in most cases, sacrifices to some degree for his way of life, and sees that as the ideal and does not engage in anything for his livelihood. If anyone does it, it's his wife, and the women, Haredi women, undertook the burden of winning their bread and the family's bread. And my wife, right, by the way, wrote about the justifications for that revolutionary move. And this was quite a revolutionary thing that created a very different, actually unprecedented kind of Jewish society where scholars are, most of the men are scholars, are studying Torah, which is not a practical subject. And only when they approach the age of 40 or so, they start looking for work because they have to marry their children as well. And the American Haredi Judaism did not go to that direction. Even most extremistic groups, first of all, even in Satmar Hasidim, for example, even encouraged their men to go to work, and only the really brilliant ones remain in study halls and study Torah. And even the Litvish, the Misnagdik, the non-Hasidic portion of the American Haredi Judaism took it quite tolerantly if someone wanted to study, take a kind of evening school, but in academic studies, yes, take evening university and prepare the way for his leaving the yeshiva and going to joining the workforces, whatever it would like to be, after he gets married, or short after he gets married, longer after he gets married. So actually, we can say that from the outset, American Judaism was much more moderate, a little more open to the wider society, at least in terms of breadwinning. And Israeli society was much more isolationist and segregationist in terms of all we know is just the yeshiva and the study hall of the Kohelel later. And if someone is engaged in this world, the activities, it's our wives. And in many ways, the Israelis, Israeli Haredim, are more closed, we would say, if we want to label it, or at least more. The other thing is that, as part of that, by the way, during the 1970s, Israeli Haredim also became a little more ideological in terms of phrasing and stating the Haredi ideology in some kind of confrontational way against the modern world, against Zionism, against the Israeli state, and everything has to do with that, a part of the influence of Rabbi Shachin at that time, since the 70s, in the 90s. So it's also kind of more Haredi or more Orthodox way within the Orthodox spectrum. The other thing in which Israel Haredim differ is the fact that if you live among Jews, among Israeli Jews, who are actually people like you, it's very different from living among Gentiles. If you live among Gentiles, the other is much more otherly, and in some ways you have to fear less. And the Israeli Haredim, when once at last, yes, in the mid-90s and on, started their processes of modernization, it came not only with modernization, but also with some sort of Israelization. In terms of, and this is different because of the very scene in which both groups work. American Haredim became more Americanized. Israeli Haredim became more Israelized, so to speak. And it comes in terms of more solidarity with the state, more solidarity with tacit, undeclared, unstated solidarity with the Zionist national nature of the state, and Hebrew culture, Hebrew slang, Hebrew literature, even journalism, anything to do with that has Hebrew internet, definitely Hebrew language for itself, yes, penetrated the Haredi world more and more. Much more, I think, than English went into the Hasidic community in the United States. Hebrew did enter the penetrate the Hasidim in Israel. So in many ways, the difference between Israeli Haredim and American Haredim is the difference between Americans and Israelis, because they really went into this culture in different levels, indeed, but step by step, they adopted many Israeli features.
I see. Well, the book does expand and illuminates the whole question of the attitudes of Haredim toward Zionism and toward Israeli politics, toward Israeli secularism. And I guess it's too wide in a topic to try and grasp in one interview. But my question in this regard would be, what do the Haredim teach us about the non-Haredi Israeli society? This is obviously not the focus of your book, but if you had to contemplate this, what would you see as the main take of this view?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think it's important to make this point clear. You know, we all the time in the modern world, in the Western world, all the time speak about the other, and we also created this term of counterculture. But to be frank, on this issue, the modern world deals mainly with kind of, let's say, fashionable others. And the Western world deals with a counterculture, which is not indeed a counterculture in terms of really countering the very, very basic tenets or dogmas of modern Western civilization. What was named counterculture in the 1960s was the hippies. Hippies actually are not really counterculture, but in terms of challenging the principles of the hegemonic society, but they're more radical on the very same values of that hegemonic society. If the Western civil, the modern Western civilization was based on values such as liberty and equality, the hippies didn't subvert the ideas of liberty and equality. They were more radical on the values of liberty and equality. In that terms, they are not indeed countercultural. They only demand more consistency or more radicalism from the ruling class or ruling hegemony to be more loyal to its own values or to be more consistent with its own values rather than questioning that those values proper. This is actually what the Haredim do. Haredim are counterculture in the true sense of the word. They did not come from the very same cradle of liberty and equality of the French Revolution, all that stuff. They were countering that wave since its outset. They really do not believe in human autonomy. They don't believe in liberty in the sense of not being subjected to authority. They're, of course, religious, while hegemony is secular in its nature. They're also not about equality, certainly not of women, certainly not of Jews and Gentiles. They're really, in fact, the real counterculture in terms of challenging our very basic premises or even dogmas of Western civilization. Even my chapter on their criticism of democracy, some of what I'm saying now is in that chapter as well, because democracy is about liberty and equality as well. And democracy, after the fall of the Eastern Bloc, is actually taken for granted. While the Haredim, we don't see it often that way, but we have to see it that way. They, among other things, they also offer us a different form of government. First of all, it's not a state-based government. It's a community within a sovereign state. It does not presume to have sovereignty, but it does exert power and authority through social pressure and other means. And it does have its own hierarchy and its own forms of ruling of governing, and those who stand at the top of this social political pyramid are the sages, the Torah scholars. In some way, the Haredim is a religious form that is, so to speak, the closest to the Platonic Republic of philosopher king. It's not philosopher, it's Torah sage, but it's the man of letters, the man of the intellectual, so to speak, who governs, who stands at the top of the pyramid. So in many ways, the most basic tenets of Western society are challenged by the Haredim and are challenged much, much more fiercely, but on the other hand, much more gently, because they don't really argue with, they all the time see themselves as being in defense. And they don't really argue or dispute or engage in debates against modern values or a modern philosophy or modern ideology or anything having to do with that. They're much more engaged in defending and building their own walls against that modernity. But within their interior discourse, they all the time challenge modernity, and they all the time offer a different perspective on the world. That managed to even survive the strong waves of modernity, both in the 19th century and later in 20th century, survived all those big, strong waves of the age of ideologies, and keep challenging modern culture and modern values even today. And I think an open-minded person, not once again, open-minded is always, the term open-minded is always attached to someone who is liberal. Open-minded in the literal sense of the world, a person who is open to see other perspective of the world and try to get into their mind, even if he really rejects them and doesn't want to adopt them. The Haredi worldview is actually fascinating for such a person because it does offer such challenges.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to note how Israeli society has chosen to other the Haredim and not necessarily heed the criticism or at least pay attention to the criticism. And this maybe moves us to another issue. Well, you described your work as a combination of a history of ideas and a sociological or maybe ethno-political view of the society. And any sociological study of a closed community like the Haredim has to cope with the problem of voyeurism. You give in the book a very detailed account of daily life, of practices, of dress, of even rules regarding sexual relations between the sexes and so on and so forth. And one would be simply overwhelmed to read such a review of other sects or other segments of Israeli society. I was thinking while reading your book, what would happen if someone wrote a similar review of Israeli Tel Avivi seculars, for example? This would be just another, either a joke or a reason for protest in the street. So the question I want to pose to you is, how does one avoid, when writing about such a closed society, who is by definition refusing to open up to such analysis, how does one write about it without falling into the trap of voyeurism?
Mm-hmm. Right. Actually, you know who asked me this question? A Haredi broadcaster that interviewed me for a Haredi radio station. He asked me, you're writing about us. Why won't you write a guide to the secular society? And don't you look at us as just as a biologist looks at penguins? Penguins in the North Pole, he said. So, no, it's not that. And the this is one of the things in which this book differs from previous books that have been written about Haredim. And they, here comes the importance of the chapters of Haredi ideology. All those segments in some of the Hasidic groups of them are right about, I really go into details about their interior conflicts and even to, I would say, kind of semi-gossip about the interior dynamics that go within them. It's always, but always, even when I go into those, sharp, spicy stories, it's always a background. It's always just a context for the text, a context that gives you a kind of a gateway into the real thing, into the more important thing, which are the chapters on Haredi thought, Haredi values, Haredi beliefs. And I insist that if I wrote only about Haredi beliefs, Haredi ideology, not only that it would be worse for the sales, but it would be wrong methodologically, because Haredi worldview is created in constant dialogue and is created with the outside side, but also is created in constant responses to interior dynamics. And interior dynamics are often very mundane and very earthly, and we get to understand that. For example, in my subchapter about Vizhnitz Hasidism, I show that the family story of the Vizhnitz Rebbe's dynasty is standing in the background of some of the changes that Vizhnitz went through in this generation. In this generation, Vizhnitz has become from more centrist kind of Haredi group into more radical, ideological, more segregationist and anti-modern than before, even anti-Zionist than before, because the present Rebbe is such a type. And the present Rebbe is such a type because he went through all kinds of conflicts in his life. And if we want to portray his figure, his personality, his ideological personality, you have to get into those nitty-gritty details, family story and all that stuff. But at the end of the road, it's not him that is interesting or his family story. What is interesting is the more substantive description of Haredi ideology, Haredi values, Haredi differences between Haredi groups and their stories and their values and beliefs and their norms, practical norms. And what the reader, I expect at least the reader to come up with is not how those small stories really shape Haredi Judaism. No, I want the reader to come up with the notion of how variegated is Haredi society, how different the Haredim are from one another, how within this very common features of or dogmas of Haredi ideology there are variances, differences, conflicts, debates, interior debates. And all these issues are really one big kind of mixture of different kinds of descriptions, which the book tries to go between and try to find the balance between. So that's a part of the answer, I think, to this question. Voyeurism is what you may call voyeurism, gossip, or whatever. could be there to some levels, but it's never ever the main thing, and it's all means to the end. And I always really strict about it with myself, and hope managed. Mm-hmm.
Well, Professor Brown, we've taken too much of your time. Can you please tell us, as in closing, what you're currently working on?
First of all, there is a second volume to this book. I promised that second volume in my introduction of The Guide to Haredi Society, and now I fulfilled that promise. And this volume, unlike the first volume, is more centered on sociology. Once again, when I speak about centered on sociology, it's called Guide to Haredi Society, Structures and Dynamics, which is less about beliefs and groups, but more about social dynamics and structures. But once again, I'm very strict about that as well, that when I speak about structures and dynamics, it's not only politics, sociology, economy, housing, etc., but it's also about education. And when I describe Haredi education, it's kind of actually describing how yeshiva looks like in terms of atmosphere, but also in terms of curriculum and study methods. And a part of the dynamics in the Haredi world is not only about sociology, but also about culture. And two chapters are dedicated in the new book to Haredi literature, Haredi ideological and theological literature in one chapter, and Haredi halachic, legal theoretical, I don't know, it's not legal theoretical, but legal kind of less practical literature. All those are also analyzed in depth and in detail in this new book. So it's kind of complementary book to the previous one. Another thing is I'm working on, once again, it's really near future, kind of it's really in last stages, is a book on Karlin Hasidism. I'm also a part of a group that wrote the book Hasidism, New History, that's about to appear in this December in Princeton University Press. And part of my interest in Hasidism is that I focused on Karlin Hasidism, a very interesting Hasidic group, one of the earliest ones and exists to date, and is quite different from the theological Hasidic groups that are often studied, such as Chabad and Breslev. This is much less theology-centered Hasidism, but has its own interesting world of values, beliefs, and social dynamics. And apart from these interests, I'm also still more or less in general philosophy. So I have published this summer a book on epistemology, but I'm working thoroughly on a book on formal ontology, which I assume will have much lesser and smaller readership than my books on Judaism. I don't have any illusions about that, but it's okay. That's also one of the prices you have to pay, and that's one of the things I'm most interested in, so it's okay with me.
Well, Professor Brown, this all sound like a great project. I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. I learned from it, and take care. And to you listeners, thank you for listening. Please make sure to check out other interviews in our newly established Israel Studies channel, and bye-bye.